You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 97. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about decolonial approaches to writing and teaching Indigenous history and geography. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nuuch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Lindsay Montgomery, Dr. Kalani Hines, and Dusty Bridges on the show, and they are going to introduce themselves.
Hi, everybody. My name's Lindsay. I'm an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto. And my work is really informed by community-based approaches and brings together a lot of different methods from historical archaeology, from ethnohistory, and also geospatial types of analysis to try to understand inter-ethnic interactions, primarily in the North American Southwest.
Aloha mai kako. My name is Kalani Hines. I am an assistant professor of American Indian Studies at California State University, Northridge. My training is in Hawaiian archaeology, where I focus on using Olelo Hawaii, or the Hawaiian language-based text, to reconstruct the landscape prior to and during the sugarcane plantation period. And I'm currently working towards building a native sciences program.
And hi, my name is Dusty Bridges. I'm currently a PhD candidate in anthropological archaeology at Cornell University. And my research focuses on using archaeology and working with legacy collections that have been removed from communities to reassess harmful colonial narratives. And particularly, I work with Haudenosaunee communities, what is now upstate New York, around traditions of incorporation and adoption that have been misconstrued in the historical record to be something harmful. I use a kind of archaeology and geography mixed methods that I got from my undergraduate studies at Texas State University.
Love it. So I'm very excited to talk about that. I love the different interests and how they also play nicely together. I first heard about the three of you from a session that you did at the Theoretical Archaeological Group, right?
Yeah.
Okay. In Santa Fe last year, someone came back from that conference raving about your session and how I had to do a podcast episode with people from that session. So reached out to Dr. Montgomery and very excited that we were finally able to pull this together and hear more about this session that left such an impression. Very excited to spend some time with you all today.
I'll say it's really great to hear that the session was well received because it was a little bit of outside the box format. And this is something that the Theoretical Archaeology Group conferences really facilitate in a way that I don't think traditional professional conferences do. So it was a unique platform for us to be able to do this. I think it's also important to note, before I say anything more about the session, is that Santa Fe was actually a very historic tag in that it was the first of this conference that was held at a totally tribally run and tribally owned hotel and conference center. And we were at the Hickory's Pueblo's hotel called Hotel Santa Fe. And they were a sponsor for the conference, and they were also the recipients of the conference fees, the proceeds. So it was an attempt to start to give back to Indigenous communities and realign the way archaeology and Indigenous communities have been. So that was a really cool venue. And our session, which was co-organized by me and Dr. Nathan Acebo, was focused on Indigenous futurities. And the idea of Indigenous futurities and the ways in which Indigenous communities and individuals are taking actions in order to ensure their futures. And we were looking at this from both a historical standpoint, but also from a geography standpoint, which is why we broadened the umbrella of folks who were invited beyond just archaeology, firmly under the umbrella of traditional Southwest archaeology. What was different about the format was that we used a salon format. Half of the session was folks giving kind of short papers discussing their work. And then the second half of the session was just discussion where people can move around to different groups. And we had some question prompts around the idea of Indigenous futures. And it just created a free kind of flowing discussion and meet and greet where different people got to come together and talk about things in a way that you don't usually see at most conferences where you're just sitting in a room passively consuming information. I think a couple of community members from different tribes in New Mexico got talking to some different scholars and they started talking about forming a tribal historic preservation office. So it was cool because a lot of different avenues that conversations ended up taking.
So could you all maybe give a little bit of background first on, because I believe Kalani and Dusty, right, you both gave more talks and then Lindsay, you were more leading the discussion part. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So maybe Kalani and Dusty, could you maybe give a little intro into what you guys talked about specifically? And then Lindsay, if you wouldn't mind talking about the discussion portion a little bit more.
Sure.
In my talk, I primarily focused on the classroom as a space to enable, help perpetuate Native futurities. And so I talked a lot about what I'm doing in my American Indian Studies classes, stuff that I'm trying out for the very first time in order to really critique this often colonial four-walled classroom type of education that we see in a lot of universities today. So just for a couple examples of things I talked about, I think this is probably the favorite one that I had a couple of people come up to me after, was how I enter my classroom on the first day of school and I sit in the back. I wear very casual clothes. I usually wear a rugby jersey, ripped jeans, and a backwards baseball cap. And then when it comes to the time for the class to start, I go up to the front of my classroom and I ask them, how many of you thought I was your professor? And it gives a way to really deconstruct what educated looks like and to really rethink how I'm going to be in the classroom, because I don't look like how a lot of people expect me to be, right? I have a full sleeve tattoo. I'm pretty young. And I think that from the beginning allows students to start rethinking and challenging their norms.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my presentation. When I first got the call for papers, I was so excited because I was in the weeds with the dissertation chapter I was writing that was about archaeology and geography. And this call for papers was just, oh, it was beautiful. But I had been thinking about, as an archaeologist, particularly an archaeology grad student, that we have access to a lot of materials that communities don't. In my work, I have access to this gigantic collection of Onondaga Seneca archaeology materials in a museum over the course of my project that really was disconnected from the community. It hadn't been studied. It's an orphaned legacy collection. It was created by avocational archaeologists, so there wasn't a lot of context, and it generally gets ignored. So I had been thinking about archaeology as a form of mapping, as a way of combining Indigenous geographies that think about place as a collection of experiences and relations and knowledges and stories instead of just space, and how archaeology can also be that for these materials that are unrelated. And so my presentation was about how I'm conceptualizing this kind of archaeology as mapping practice, combining archaeology and Indigenous studies. It's not so much about teaching like Dr. Hines's presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are two very different, but I can see some ties. So Lindsay, how did you, obviously there were those two and then there was more presentations. So how did the discussion flow from all of that?
Yeah, so what we did was group of short kind of presenters. And then we invited a whole bunch of other people who we thought would be interesting to have a conversation with, who weren't presenting, but who do various different things within archaeology and outside of it related to Indigenous futurities, Indigenous histories, and geographies. And we originally, I'll say what we intended and then I'll tell you what happened. So it would be structured in that we would have two kind of thematic prompts. One that was focus on placemaking and how do you think about Indigenous futures in particular places. And then the other prompt was oriented around storytelling and mapping. And so what are some more of a kind of methods type of discussion? What are the different ways that we might be able to get at Indigenous futures, both in the past and present? And so we had those prompts and we had these tables that we set up in the conference room. And what we had imagined was that people would talk to each other about the prompts and then we'd switch it up and people could move around and then people would talk about the other prompt. And what immediately happened was that maybe people started with the prompt, but primarily they just started talking to each other and people moved in and out of the space. Some conversations were really academic and they were oriented around these sorts of theoretical and methodological questions. And other conversations were totally casual and were just people talking to each other about what they did. And it became something that was not necessarily what we had imagined or intended, but I think it was still effective in that it brought people into a room to think about what Indigenous futures means. And many of the people in the room identify as Indigenous themselves.
I think it became a great embodiment of placemaking just because connections were made, stories were told.
People weren't really theorizing about it. They were just doing it.
Sorry, I'm copying over the names from the sessions in case you guys wanted to do a shout out or something.
I could name all the people.
Okay.
So in terms of folks who gave presentations, right, we have Dr. Hines and Dusty, but also Gerald Oetler and Schneider. Those were our main presenters. And then in terms of the folks that we had invited to join in the conversation, Dr. Bailey Marquez from the University of Maryland, Dr. Nicholas Lalick from UC Berkeley, Dr. Wade Campbell from Boston, Dr. Robert Purcell from Brown, Dr. Joseph Sweener from the University of New Mexico, Dr. Desiree Martinez from Cogstone Resource Management, and Dr. Mishawana Goman from the University of Buffalo. So we had folks from all over, all coming in with different perspectives.
That's such an impressive group of people right there. Yeah, it was cool too, because I was like, oh, several of them have been on the podcast before, like even multiple times, like Wade and Desiree have both been on like, I don't know, 2-3, maybe even 4 times. I don't even remember. So yeah, I was like, I know those guys. That's quite a crew. That's awesome. Definitely makes me sad that I missed it. Sadly, we are already at our first break point. I know, it's crazy. It goes so fast. When we come back, I think it'd be interesting to hear if there were any particular highlights or discussion topics that really stood out to people from this session. And on that, I'll let that marinate with everybody and we will be right back. All right. So I'm excited to hear about highlights, discussion points, things that stood out to you during the session.
So many. I don't want to.
I think I was so nervous speaking in front of this room of really cool people that I admired that I blanked out a lot.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was going to say, the editors can edit that out, but I also think it's great because who hasn't done that?
Oh, feel free. Be real. Students listening, it's totally normal to just blank out.
Have an outer body experience.
With your academic heroes. But seriously, who hasn't been there? So, Dr. Hines, I guess it's on you.
I was just saying, I'm right there with you. No, I think the most memorable was like the unique format, because you usually don't get that experience at a conference where you can just be in a room of so many cool people from different avenues of life and different areas and sectors and whatnot. I remember talking about, seed libraries. I remember talking about different Indigenous-centered archaeological companies and just the different works people were doing. But yeah, all just like flows together.
I was still fully conscious the whole time. I stayed at one table for a pretty long time. One of the cool things that I remember talking to folks about, one, I'll just also co-sign on what, which is it was interesting to be able to talk to folks who were both in academia and then also outside of academia. And that's a little bit different from, I think, sometimes a lot of professional archaeology or anthropology conferences. And I think part of the reason why we got a broader audience at our session was because it was located in Santa Fe. And mm-hmm. we made an effort. I was also an organizer of PAG that year. We really made an effort to try to reach out and advertise and invite tribal members to come to the conference. A lot of the folks who work in CRM or in TIPO's offices in the Southwest to join in. So I think that was really gave us a breadth of perspectives in there that we wouldn't have usually gotten. And one of the conversations that I remember having with a gentleman who worked in Texas, which is what was a big facet of my dissertation work. And it was really interesting talking to them about how they've been working with the Comanche Nation and differences and similarities in the history of Comanche land use in Texas and how everybody in Texas has a Quanaparca story.
That's true.
and just kind of being able to expand the out of the kind of bubble that I think we often get into as archaeologists. We often get into very regional and topical bubbles. And that was what was cool about the salon format was that we could actually get out of our bubbles.
That's what podcasting does.
I absolutely agree. If I could think of something that I remembered, I was talking to another grad student that also works in Texas, those Texans. But we were talking about how our work intersects, even though we're totally different parts of the country. I work primarily in upstate New York, and she works in Texas. This grad student is Kelton Sheridan, does great work at Mission Espada in Texas. There. But it was so cool being in a space that encouraged this kind of out-of-the-box thinking and interdisciplinarity. I feel like so much of academia is getting siloed into disciplinary boxes. And so being in a space where you had perspectives from people in archaeology, but dabbling elsewhere, and where that kind of dabbling was encouraged, and then community perspectives bringing in all of that together. It was really nice. It was really generative, and it was placemaking, kin making, mapping, relations, buzzwords.
What were there things that came out of it where you're like, oh, this is the next thing we need to do, or next topic we want to talk about, or next time there's a conference session, we should do this?
So I'll put the spotlight on Kalani again. I'm very interested in thinking more critically about how we teach archaeology, because I think there's been a decent amount of conversation around collaborative methodology and decolonizing our kind of archaeological toolkits and trying to develop more capacity building and power sharing relationships with Indigenous peoples and critical narratives of Indigenous history. But I think there's been much less rigorous interrogation of how are we actually communicating archaeological history to undergraduates? How are we communicating archaeology to the public? How are we communicating Indigenous histories to the public? And really, really thinking critically about how we're doing that and what types of narratives we are perpetuating or not. And so I haven't actualized this, but I'm very interested in exploring that aspect more. So Kalani, if you want to do a session with me, then, you know,
I'm also very keen to learn from Dr. Hines about this.
All I have to say is basically this has been I became an assistant professor. This is my second year. And so it's been a huge learning experience. A lot of trial and error.
Yes.
Definitely. And I think the main reason I was able to even look into this was, one, because I'm at a teaching university, which is great. When you teach multiple classes, you have multiple students or multiple different areas where you can experiment. There's been successes and not so big of successes, but I'm also feel really fortunate actually to my college, because I went in my interview for my job telling my dean exactly what I do. And he was like, okay, that sounds great. I was surprised to hear that because I'm very much like, I'm going to go outside this framework that you're used to. I think that's one of the big things and things I've been fortunate about being at CSUN, that they're just like, they're not like, oh, we have a strict curriculum, you need to follow it or else. Same with my program. They're like, we hire you to do native sciences within a humanities college, something that seems counterintuitive, but they're all for it.
I am very curious to see what happens over the next 5 years with the current political landscape in the United States.
I'm just going to ask that.
Because it's amazing that at Dr. Hines's institution, she got the kind of green light and the institutional support to be able to classes in critical pedagogy, decolonial pedagogy, anti-racist pedagogy that she's been doing. And the question is, especially at big state institutions, whether that will be possible in the same way as it was before.
Yeah. And for context, this is being recorded in late February 2025. It's not going to release for a while after that. So right now we're, you know, not too long after Trump was freezing DEI funding. There may be updates between when this is recorded and when you hear it, but this is a moment where I think this is all on all of our minds right now.
Just echoing that, between the talks between the different ethnic studies programs or departments at my university is something we're all concerned about. Also, they're cutting funding and cutting the budget to the CSU. So it's definitely
I didn't know that.
Conversation.
Yeah, I think it's getting real. Is what's happening, right? It's, and I know this is happening at other big state institutions like the University of Arizona, where I used to be before I came to Toronto, where they're asking administrators to go in and review all of the policies and programs. And there, I think it will be important for people in administration as well as outside of it to really advocate for these types of programs, because if they aren't advocated for, they will be easily erased or whittled down to something so insignificantly impactful that they might as well have been erased.
Speaking of University of Arizona, that's where I went to undergrad. So hi. Yeah.
Bear down, go Cats.
Bear down. Yes. It's definitely a moment. And yeah, there's in all sorts of fields, and obviously anthropology, this is something front and center for us, anthropology and related fields. But I was talking to a friend who works in medicine not too long ago. I came through her clinic and tore down anything related to DEI. And it's a like the type of place that is normally known for being especially like welcoming and serving like low-income community and all everybody. So it was like very jarring for them. So it's happening across the board for sure. And by the time that this airs, hopefully it'll be in a better place, but we'll see.
Can I jump in with a thought?
Yeah, absolutely.
I just thinking about teaching and writing Indigenous history in this current context. Indigenous history, as it's been taught and written prior to the work of people like Dr. Montgomery and Dr. Hines, has been a tool of erasure, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think it's even more important right now to continue working and writing in the way that Dr. Montgomery and Dr. Hines are, to tell Indigenous histories from a different perspective, right? From Indigenous perspectives, from community perspectives, from decolonial and anti-colonial perspectives. I think it just highlights how important it is at this moment.
The approaches that I've taken are definitely informed by the work of a lot of other folks who have been doing this much longer than I have. People like Dr. Randy McGuire, Dr. Mark Leote, and my advisor at Stanford, Dr. Michael Wilcox. What we see now more than ever as what constitutes truth and truth claims, it increasingly becomes a matter of debate. I think it becomes even more important to have people writing revisionist histories that center different perspectives than what has been traditionally privileged. So I think this moments of kind of radical populism, like what we see happening now, I think it's very important to continue to write critical history.
To echo that, like, students are yearning for it. So many of my students enter the class being really upset that this is the history that they never learned, and just being like surprised and being like, wow. Because the way I teach an American Indian and US history course, it's basically the resounding theme is this isn't just in the past. We see these repercussions in the present. It's still going on. And then I see students with this yearning urgency to do something, to try to figure out ways that they can help. And I think that's what's needed right now.
Yeah. On that super uplifting note, I guess, no, it is though, like, students are the future. We are at our second break point, and when we get back, we'll continue this discussion. All right. We are back from our break, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about the main theme of the session, which was Indigenous futurities. Dr. Montgomery, you gave a little bit of an intro to that concept at the beginning, but could you maybe give some examples of what that looks like? And obviously, if the other two of you want to join in, that would be great too.
Yeah. So I guess the reason why there's a kind of rhetorical difference, I would say, between future and futurities is that the future is a time that has yet to happen, whereas futurities is really about, it's emphasizing actions that are taken in the present, but which reflect on the past and which then shape the future, right? Mix those three things together, past, present, future, and it's focusing on the actions. And this is something that Dr. Laura Harjo really spells out really nicely in a book called Spiral to the Stars, which was published in 2019. And there she lays out, in the context of the Muscogee Creek peoples, kind of different types of what she calls emergence geographies, remembers to shape the future of the tribal nation, that have kind of concrete aspects like architectural aspects, also what she calls ephemeral and metaphysical, and then virtual practices. So these are all like different realms of practice. And one of the ways that I've kind of thought about this in my work is actually looking at the ways in which tribal members were shaping the reservation landscape during what I will call loosely the boarding school era, which is roughly 1870 until about 1930 or so. And so thinking about in the kind of recent historical past, how were Lakota folks actually shaping the landscape in ways that were negotiating the colonial realities of allotment and forced attendance at day schools and residential schools, but also through various other types of practices that actually maintained long-standing Indigenous ways of relating to the landscape and relating together as community. So one good example of this is the fact that during the allotment period, during the boarding school era, there was a separate families, extended family groups into nuclear households, and to force them onto these really highly separated allotments, right? So they can no longer commune together, and then to compel them to send their children to schools. And what a lot of Lakota families did was, one, they didn't just stay still, right? They kept moving. They kept moving in a very kind of like seasonal way to coalesce into larger kin groups and these kind of mobile industries, rather than taking up things like sedentary agriculture, which is the big thing that the government programs were advocating for Indigenous people across the United States. They wanted everybody to become agriculturalists, everybody to become farmers. And so there was a continuity in terms of mobility. People kept moving. They kept using teepees instead of building log cabins. They actively selected to have allotment plots with their extended family groups so that they would create blocks that could replicate old forms of camping together. Those were all intentional choices, right, that were being made by people to ensure the collective survival of the community.
When I think of Indigenous futurities, I usually think of it in the Hawaiian context. So I think of the Hawaiian wise saying, Ikavama mua kavama hope, the future is in the past. And I think that sentiment has really shaped who I am as an archaeologist and the work I do. For example, in Hawaiian culture, knowing your mo'okuauhau or your genealogy is really important. So it's something that I did simultaneously with my work, because it's the idea that you need to know your past to know your kuleana or your responsibility in the present and future. In terms of my dissertation work and the work that I'm doing now, I was really trying to do something that's important to our community. So Olelo Hawaii has always factored really largely the Hawaiian language into something I want to learn, do. It felt like a kuleana responsibility to me. And that, I guess, kind of tugging from my ancestors, so to speak, really led me to my dissertation topic, or my dissertation method, rather, which is using these mahele texts. So basically, these land claim records, for those who are not familiar with the mahele, some of which are written in Olelo Hawaii, to understand, okay, what was the landscape like before? How much lo'ikalo, how much irrigated taro was on the landscape, in order to really understand how drastically sugarcane plantations altered the landscape, caused water diversions, really harmed the Hawaiian population. But in this process, I also discovered other uses for the mahele records. Specifically, we know about less than 1%. The numbers have been kind of debated by different scholars, but I'll just say around less than 1% of different Hawaiian commoners ended up retaining the lands after the mahele. There's been reasons why people suggest that Hawaiian commoners didn't claim land. The simplest explanation is it just was an entire different way of living and conceiving the world, because in Hawaiian culture, land is our ancestor, so ownership doesn't really make sense. You caretake for an ancestor, you don't own it. And so what I found out, though, is that the mahele records would say things like, oh, this person is to the right of me, this person is to the left of me, this person is above me, below me. And you could use these records and compare them to one another to understand where other people who didn't make claims on the landscape were. And I think I ended up finding about 50% more people on the landscape.
In my research, I'm reassessing these narratives of enslavement and decline among the Haudenosaunee when they took in a whole bunch of other Indigenous outsiders into their communities around the 17th and 18th century. And so this is written about as if it was a terrible thing. It clearly signified that these communities were in decline. They had to take in outsiders. But when we relate that back into Haudenosaunee traditions, we find that these incorporations and adoptions were more about ensuring the futures of the communities. And it played out in a way that was generative, and identities were formed and relations were made. It was really kin-making in these communities in the past. And so that's futurities in this kind of historical sense, but also in the process of doing this work, I think about futurities in what we're doing right now to address this historical futurities. And so it's played out in a kind of relating of material culture into contemporary communities. So there's one particular artifact that I deal with a lot, which is the carved bone comb. And so in the process of looking at the materials and studying them, I realized that I was seeing a lot of these combs, and I knew a Nondawaka Haudenosaunee comb artist. And so I said, would you like to see these for your work so you can work with them, work with these ancestral designs? And he said yes. And so Hayden Haynes is an antler carver, and we've been working on a project to make those combs accessible. And so that kind of contributes to the continuation of practices, artistic practices that connect Waka people in the present to the people in the past and ensure future practices. So it's kind of twofold: futurities in the past, futurities in the present.
Yeah. All of the examples that we just talked about is the fact that they draw attention to what types of sources we use as evidence to think about Indigenous past and present. And how looking at different types of evidence, whether it's language or if it's oral histories or if it's materials or doing a reading between the lines of the archives, that putting together types of evidence that you might not necessarily put together really can create totally different perspectives and narratives than what currently exists.
Yeah, that I'm glad we talked about that because that added a lot more depth to my understanding of the concept. So yeah, that's definitely, like you said, not just looking at the future as a future thing, but the past and present actions and how that shapes actively the future. That's fascinating. To finish out this segment, which it's crazy how fast this goes, I would love to hear from each of you about if there's anything that you're currently working on that you're excited about or that you're looking forward to working on in the future.
What is our futurities? Well, maybe to give some context for what I do and the whole relationship with how TAG got started is that since 2017, I've been working on a tribally led multi-institutional project with Pickery's Pueblo. And one of the fascinating things about how this project has evolved is that it started out as my colleagues, Dr. Mike Adler and Dr. Seb Fells and myself, and saying that the community wanted to start a museum and could we help? And it's evolved now into a National Science Foundation supported project that was starting to look at and document the community's agricultural fields. And then it's evolved again now to become basically a long-term collaboration with us and the community around their evolving heritage needs. And so there's not like a kind of concrete output right now that I'm looking forward to, but it's more just the ability to continue building that collaborative relationship with Pickery's and continuing to facilitate capacity building and to think about what archaeology can actually do for the community needs change.
I'm moving towards developing a native sciences lab, so kind of in some ways an extension of teaching, but really re-envisioning what science looks like. If plants are relatives, if art or material culture artifacts are relatives because they were initially plants, then how do we engage with them in ways that are culturally appropriate? How do we set protocols that are not just based on scientific methods and safety standards, but how do we combine all that? How do we integrate art, elders, planting? I'm particularly interested in the environmental sciences, going towards paleobot, diatoms, and phytoliths are my jam. I really think we can learn so much more, not diverging from just focusing on built structures, but looking at what plants can tell us. In Hawaiian culture, you can see it in our Ōlelo Noi Ao, our Hawaiian way of sayings. You can see it on the landscape. Plants were used as tools of communication. I always joke with my class. I always ask them, okay, so if you call someone a banana tree in Hawaiian, what does that mean? What do we know about the nature of the banana tree? Students always guess a bunch of things, like they're big and strong. And it's like, no, it means you're weak because banana trees fall at the store. They're very like hollow base. And so just like an example I've seen on the landscape, you can usually find tea leaf plants planted around more like sacred sites. So I really want to understand like how we can go about to see what plants can communicate to us.
So that if you go to Hawaii and get called a banana tree.
That is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, for sure.
What I'm looking forward to is more about looking towards stuff that I've already started. So the antler carver I mentioned previously, Hayden Haynes and I started to work on a digital collection of the combs to make them more accessible to other folks in the community and to really engage cyberspace as a kind of placemaking place on the internet. It's been slow going because I am the technical support and I'm not a very technical person. So been learning, leaning into the digital humanities space. I'll also be translating what I find in my dissertation into a more digestible, public-facing format. I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yeah, and that's interesting because that ties into what Kalani was just talking about too, with material culture being relatives. That's really interesting. I'd be curious what the person you're working with would have to say about that.
Me too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not going to ask you to speak for them today.
Also, I forgot to give a shout out to Auntie Fran, who is head curator at Payam Museum, where talking with her made me rethink about material culture as ancestors. She's doing really cool stuff with the museum. I really recommend, if you're in the Long Beach area or anywhere in Los Angeles, check it out. It's like a re-envisioning how we do museum studies.
Okay, we'll have to find the website or Facebook group or whatever for this museum and put it in the show notes, because that sounds awesome. Cool. Okay. Well, we are at the end, but does anyone have any like burning things to tell the audience?
Be nice to me.
Yeah. If you meet Dusty at a conference,
she'll remember you. That's good. Oh, no, thank you, Jessica, for the invitation. And yeah, even though this group kind of had conversations at TAG, it's these sorts of things that continue the dialogue and I think are actually really generative. And it's always great to hear what other folks are doing, because it is often very isolating work in academia.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I appreciate all of you so much. The hard thing with like a panel episode is like each time one of you would talk, I'd be like, oh my God, I have so many follow-up questions for this one person. I wish we could do all three, but then you guys talk to each other and also more interesting stuff comes out. So pros and cons, right? I greatly appreciate each of you coming on and sharing your stories. And it sounds like you're all doing really fascinating work. And I definitely appreciate the work that you're doing in addition to coming on this podcast. So thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully, who knows, maybe someday we'll have you guys back on for something else. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.